All right, hello everyone. Good morning and welcome to our HTI 1 proposed rule task force under the Health IT Advisory Committee. Thank you for joining today. My name is Seth Tuzinski with ONC, and I'll be serving as the designated federal official for today's meeting, filling in for Mike Berry. I just want to remind folks that all task force meetings are open to the public and your feedback is welcomed. You can do so in two ways. One is throughout the meeting, you can put comments in the Zoom chat feature, or you can make comments verbally during our public comment period, which will be taking place at 10 minutes toward the end of the meeting. So you can save your comments for then as well. I'm going to start the meeting with a roll call of the task force members. So when I call your name, please indicate that you are present. And I'll start with the co-chairs. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Morning. Stephen Eichner.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mindell Briggs Melanson.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hans Botendijk.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jim Jurgis.
Good morning.
Good morning. Anna McAllister.
Good morning.
Good morning. Aaron Meary.
Good morning.
Good morning. Kiki Loma Ushan Kentuan.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Narish Sunderland.
Good morning.
Phil Sutherland.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right, we have a full roster today. And with that, I will turn it back over to our co-chairs, Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner, to get us into our agenda.
Thank you, Seth. And good morning, everybody. Good morning, task force members. And a special welcome to the general public and welcome to our presenters as well. We've got another good meeting laid out for us today where we're going to continue working on DSI. As we started last week and are going to continue to work through that. We've got some great presentation materials to go through with Catherine and Jordan to help provide additional information. There have been a couple of contributions into the worksheet that we're using to begin to develop recommendations. Please do continue to use that worksheet and make recommendations. We'll go through them a little bit as we have time today. Stephen, do you have anything to add?
No, just again, as you say, thank you to all the task force members and members of the public who are joining us today. We've got a lot to cover, so we want to jump right in.
And from a logistics perspective, Stephen Lane is going to help identify, raise hands, and track things in chat. And I'm going to be kind of doing other aspects of the meeting. So please, if task force members do have questions, please do raise your hand electronically or make a question or add a question in the chat window. Comments made to everyone are included in the minutes. In the official records of the meeting, information included to hosts, panelists, or direct conversations with individual task force members are not. We have reserved 10 minutes towards the end of the meeting for public comment, where we will ask Seth to recognize the public, where the public can ask questions, both electronically, and we can respond. That being said, I think we'll go ahead and shift into a quick overview of our task force charge and then into the content. As a quick overview for the task force charge, the task force has been charged has been charged to evaluate and provide feedback on the NPRM, broken down into specific charge areas, such as certification program, ECR, language shifting from USCEI version 1 to version 3 in a regulatory environment, and other aspects. Those are available in the presentation for you to peruse at your leisure. Let's go to the next slide, please. Again, these are a continuation of the comments. All comments are due to ITAC and to ONC by the end of the 60-day public comment period. So we are time limited in the development and submission of our comments. So we're making good progress. We still have a ways to go, but I believe that we will be able to get there in a timely manner. Next slide. So this is again a continuation of the specific areas that we are making comments on, again, across the three work groups. While folks here are focused on subgroup two, as a reminder, you're welcome to attend any of the group meetings. They're all at 10:30 Eastern time, Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, generally speaking, for the next month and a half or so. Public is also welcome to attend all meetings. Links are available in the ONC High Tech calendar. Next slide, please. So we're now going to shift into our continued discussion of decision support interventions and predictive models, kind of continuing the discussion that we had last week. Stephen, do you have anything to add?
Simply that we've got a very full plate today, and we're going to blast through a lot of rich material before we take questions.
Thank you for that. So given that, we're going to turn the floor over to our presenters and hopefully learn quite a lot.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take it from here. This is Jordan Everson. And we're going to dive right back in kind of where we left off talking about source attributes for predictive decision support here. Next slide, please. Before doing that, a reminder that the materials in this presentation are based on the proposed rule. And while we've tried to be accurate to the proposals, this is not a legal document. And please review the proposed rule. And then also that ONC must protect the rulemaking process and comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. And that means we can present information in the proposed rule, can't interpret that information or clarify, provide further guidance. And lastly, that this communication is produced at taxpayer expense. Next slide. Next slide. So as I said, picking up where we left off with source attributes for predictive decision support interventions. And as a reminder, source attributes in the proposal would be available via link out or drill down from certified health IT for review from the module. Next slide. So we've developed a list of several source attributes specific to predictive decision support interventions. And in developing that list, we're guided by a few kind of key concepts and goals. First, we looked for attributes that were most commonly included in existing reviewed reporting guidelines, of which there are many reporting guidelines, both for the peer-reviewed literature and for kind of clinician-facing model information. We focused on attributes that would be most meaningful and interpretable in the context of health IT users and developers, that were focused on health equity, fairness, and issues of bias, and on attributes that were intended to show that the model would perform effectively outside of the specific context in which it was developed. So information like external validation and local validation. Our goals here were to minimize the number of attributes, to base them on those existing model reporting guidelines to the extent feasible, to balance prescriptiveness and flexibility, which is a topic we'll come back to in some of the requests for comments. We also sought to align with existing reference material, notably the NIST AI Risk Management Framework and the White House Blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, as well as White House executive orders. And we sought to support emerging industry-led efforts towards scorecards and other information around this, such as those pursued by the Coalition for Healthcare AI and the Health AI Partnership. Next slide. So this is the list of the 14 proposed source attributes specific specifically for predictive decision support interventions. And these would be in addition to those that we've discussed previously that apply to both evidence-based and predictive decision support interventions. And the logic here is that if a health IT module enables or interfaces with predictive DSIs, we are proposing that the module must make information about additional source attributes available to provide transparency on how the predictive DSI was designed, developed, trained, evaluated, and should be employed. These 14 attributes fall into four categories: intervention details, intervention development, quantitative measures of intervention performance, and ongoing maintenance and use. We're going to walk through each of these in at least a little bit of detail, and so I won't read through each of them right now, but thought to group them together for you all. Next slide. An important note here is that the proposals around source attributes would not require disclosing or sharing intellectual property existing in the developer's health IT. The proposed requirements would not provide information about or report any details of the specific code, pipelines, statistical processes, or algorithms used to generate model predictions, which might be considered intellectual property. Next slide. I noted that in developing these, we tried to balance between prescriptiveness of the information provided and flexibility to meet the varied use cases to which predictive models might be applied. And we've included a request for comment on whether there are items contained within the proposed source attributes that we should explicitly require as elements of source attributes information. So these are items currently listed as should within the preamble description. And the question here is, are there should components that would become explicit requirements within the regulatory text? And specific attention to three source attributes, and this will, I think, make more sense as we walk through those, where we have multiple should components. One is intended use of the intervention. Second is input features of the intervention, including description of training and test data. And the third is the external validation process, if available. Next slide. So here, starting to walk through the specific source attributes in detail. So the first is the output of the intervention, which is a description of the value that the model produces as an output, including whether the output is a prediction, classification, or other type of output. And the intention here is that users evaluating the model can decide whether to use the output and ensure that the output is directly relevant to the way in which the user intends to use it, so that it's not predicting something that isn't directly relevant to a given use case. The second attribute is intended use of the intervention, which is a description of the intent of the model developers and how the model is meant to be deployed and used. Here is an example where we've included several should statements and requested comment around these. And the should statements are whether the model is intended for specific or general tasks, who the intended patient population is, who the intended users of the model are, as well as the intended action of the user, the role of the model, which could be conveyed through a taxonomy like that developed by the International Medical Device Regulators Forum, the American Medical Association, or the Consumer Technology Association, each of which has produced separate but related taxonomies. And lastly, here, the logic underlying the model, including the exact question the algorithm is supposed to answer. So each of these are included in the description of the preamble, but are not listed individually in regulatory text in the proposed rule. Next slide. The next source attribute here is the caution out of scope use of the intervention, which is a description of tasks, situations, or populations to which the model developer cautions a user against applying the predictive model. I'll note, Ike, in prior comments, you had concerns about models being used in inappropriate situations, and this would be within the construct of the source attributes, a place where information around that could live. And so this would include known risks, inappropriate settings, inappropriate uses, or known limitations. And these descriptions should inform users about tasks or populations related to the intended use of the model in which the model may not perform as expected. Another source attribute is around input features of the intervention, including descriptions of training and test data. And this is another where we include several should statements and request comment. So exclusion and inclusion criteria that influenced who was included in data sets, statistical characteristics of the demographic and other key variables in training and test data, the source and clinical setting from which the training and test data was generated, the extent of missing values, and other attributes related to data quality are all items that should be included within the source attribute. Next slide. Further in the intervention development category, we have the process used to ensure fairness in development of the intervention, which is a description of the approach the model developer has taken to ensure that the model output is fair. We know there are many such approaches that one could take, and we are not prescriptive about what process a developer might take to ensure fairness, but do propose that information around these processes be provided through source attributes. And an example would be to say that in pre-processing the data, the developers employed a disparate impact remover transformation across race or ethnicity groups based on a well-known approach. You know, simply an example of which there are many potential approaches. The next attribute here is external validation process, if available, which is a description of how and in what source, clinical setting, or environment a model's validity and fairness has been assessed other than the source, training, and testing data. And this is another one with a list of items that should be included. Who conducted the external testing? Was it the model developer, a developer of certified health IT, or an independent third party? What was the setting from which the external data was derived, the demographics of patients and external data, and a brief description of how external validation was carried out. And here I'll note, we include this if available phrase, which indicates that if this information is available and was developed by and was performed by the developer, it should be included in source attributes. But if this information is not available, it should be clearly indicated as not available for user review. Next slide. This slide actually covers seven of the source attributes, and they are those related to quantitative measures of intervention performance. So first we have three source attributes related to validity of prediction, corresponding to validity in test data and, if available, external data and local data. And this is a presentation of the measures or set of measures related to the model's validity. You can think as examples, sensitivity and specificity. And that is validity tested in data derived from the same source as the initial training data, in data from an external source, and in data local relative to its current use. In other words, from perhaps the health system it is being used in. Importantly, this proposal would not prescribe specific performance or validation measures. It's simply that information must be included in some cases, if available. We have a parallel set of source attributes around fairness of the prediction in test data, and if available, in external data and local data. And again, these are measures, the presentation of measures related to fairness derived from data that's the same source as the training data, in data from an external source, and in data local relative to its current use. And this, again, is a place where there are numerous approaches to measure fairness, and we're not prescribing a specific measure. We've included several examples here, and as in the proposed rule, and would think, you know, many of these are case-specific, what the best measure might be. And lastly here, we include references to evaluations of use of the model on outcomes, if available, and this would be bibliographical citations or links to evaluations showing the use of the model on objectives such as reduced morbidity, mortality, length of stay, or other important outcomes. So think information that might be generated from clinical trials or other studies of the model. Next slide. In the last category of source attributes focuses on ongoing maintenance and use and includes the update and continued validation or fairness assessment schedule, which is a description of the process and frequency by which the model's performance is measured and monitored in the local environment and corrected when risks related to validity and fairness are identified. And information here should include how often performance is evaluated and how often the model is updated, giving an insight into the likelihood that the model may have degraded or drifted since it was last updated. And then in this section, we include the validity and fairness in local data, which I described on the prior slide. Again, measures of validity or measures of fairness generated in local data within the local context. Next slide, please. Beyond the list of 14 source attributes we've included in the proposed rule, we've also included a request for comment around numerous other source attributes that we've considered, but have not included within the current proposals. And we've listed these and several more within the proposed rule. And I do suggest, you know, taking a look at the information included there. So these items include things like information on explainability and interpretability of the model or in predictive decision support. And of note, some of this is information that we would also include within the intervention risk management proposal that Catherine will decide and describe in a few minutes. I'm not going to read through each of these, but you can see there are alternative quantitative measures, specific information for online or unlocked models, as well as other information about how the model was developed. Next slide. Another important request for comment that we wanted to highlight is that we've solicited comment on whether we should require developers of certified health IT with health IT modules certified to B11 to make source attribute information publicly available, for example, on a website similar to the existing API documentation requirements. And here we're asking for comment on whether this information would be beneficial for potential users or purchasers of models or associated technology or software and would help inform them prior to procurement of health IT and procurement of predictive DSIs integrated with certified health IT. And we also solicit comment on whether having this information available would improve public confidence in predictive DSIs, for instance, by enabling research on that underlying source attribute information. Next slide. A further request for comment, you know, we are aware that patients want to know if AI is being used in their care and understand how and why it is being used. We understand an emerging trend is for healthcare providers to inform patients about the use of these technologies, including predictive decision support in making decisions about their care. And we've solicited comment on whether existing program requirements in the communications condition and maintenance of certification are sufficient to ensure open and transparent discussion regarding the use of predictive DSIs in patient care, including discussion between users of certified health IT and patients. So really asking if the communications condition is sufficient here, and we're interested in knowing if additional requirements around the technical capability for users to access underlying source attribute information would be beneficial to patients understanding the use of these decision support interventions in the course of their care. So an important request for comment around patient access to this information. Next slide. We also solicit comment on testing or assessment tools that might further support transparent and trustworthiness, including consensus metrics and technical standards. We did identify numerous reporting guidelines, but they are numerous and are not all consensus and are not all in consensus. So looking for additional metrics and standards that may be achieving consensus. Also interested in comment on development and engineering of algorithmic impact assessments and development of documentation of data sets used, such as data sheets for data sets and data cards, as well as similar information. Next slide. So though we've proposed 14 source attributes, we've also proposed the ability that health IT modules provide the ability for users to author and revise attributes beyond what is proposed to support the ongoing evolution of what source attributes are important to users to make informed decisions. So we've essentially positioned the 14 proposed source attributes as a baseline or floor from which users may modify or add to fit their specific needs. This authoring and revising proposal pertains to both evidence-based decision support and predictive decision support, for which we've proposed additional source attributes already. And it would mean that a health IT module would need to support the technical ability for a limited set of users to create or edit attribute information alongside the source attributes proposed. And an example would be that if a hospital develops its own predictive DSI and thinks that there are specific pieces of information relevant to its users, they could add those pieces of information to the existing list of source attributes. Next slide. We've also proposed, and this is a general proposal, again, for both predictive decision support and other types. In the 2015 edition proposed rule, we proposed to adopt functionality that would require health IT modules to be able to record at least one action taken and by whom it was taken when a CDS intervention is provided to a user. And so we proposed at that time whether the user viewed, accepted, declined, ignored, overrode, or provided a rationale for the action taken. We also proposed that the health IT module be able to generate either a human readable display or human readable report of the responses and actions taken. In that proposal, in the final rule, we noted that many commenters stated that current systems provide a wide range of functionality. And so we did not finalize that proposal at that time. Next slide. In this proposal rule, we are proposing that Health IT module certified to B11 must be able to export such feedback data, including but not limited to the intervention, action taken, user feedback provided, user date and location, so that the export data can be associated with other relevant data. In the course of developing the rule, we heard some that the tool is not as widespread as today as it perhaps could be, and so have included this. We propose that such feedback data be available for export by users for analysis in a computable format so that it can be associated with other relevant data, such as patient information is like diagnosis, other inputs into the DSI, and the outputs of the decision support. In addition to quality improvement of decision support, we believe such a structured export would facilitate research, associating feedback data with other relevant data and linking the DSI to patient health outcomes. Next slide. And that concludes the quick run through of the source attribute information for predictive decision support. And here I would hand it over to my colleague, Catherine, to continue through the intervention risk management proposal.
Great. Thanks, Jordan. So to focus a little bit on the intervention risk management proposals, we realize that model development is not as straightforward a routine, just a technical process. We understand that the experience and judgment of developers, as much as their technical knowledge, greatly influence the appropriate selection of inputs and processing components, and also dealing with the training and experience of the developers. And so in addition to skilled modeling and robust validation and model risk cannot be eliminated, there are other tools that should be used to manage model risk effectively. And so that's part of why you'll see the proposals here. The overall kind of big picture perspective is, we propose that developers of certified health IT with health IT modules that enable or interface with predictive DSIs, that they employ or engage intervention risk management practices. We also are proposing that the summary information regarding these interventions risk management practices be made available via a publicly accessible hyperlink. We view our proposals for risk management of predictive DSIs as complementary to the proposals that Jordan just walked through on the predictive DSI source attributes. Next slide, please. As mentioned, the proposed source attributes information requirement is meant to provide the users and the implementers with sufficient information. You heard Jordan speak to that, really to understand how the model was designed, developed, tested, as well as including the model's purpose. The known limitations and the intended use, and you'll see some of that here. Correspondingly, as mentioned, the proposals for the intervention risk management, you'll see in the middle here, that's often sometimes referred to as governance. This would provide users and implementers and the wider public in some instances, including patients, with the information on how the developers certified developers of certified health IT with the health IT modules that enable an interface with predictive DSIs, how they analyze, mitigated, and governed risk throughout the technology's lifecycle. Next slide, please. So while we believe that the transparency, I'd say, regarding the technical and performance dimensions of the predictive DSI is needed, as mentioned, we believe that the transparency regarding the organizational, as well as the sometimes referred to as socio-technical competencies that were employed by those who actually developed the predictive decision support intervention. We see this as foundational for users to determine whether their predictive DSI is phased. And I know we talked about that last week. In addition to the proposed requirements, you'll see for source attributes previously, you'll see here on the slide, the proposals to require developers, to the extent a developer attests yes, they would need to do intervention risk management practices, as I mentioned earlier. But you'll see here, this is just, I would say, a brief overview of the requirements. I'll dive a little bit more in the following slides. But generally speaking, it has focuses on intervention risk management practices that includes three areas, the risk analysis, as well as risk mitigation and governance. The other kind of piece you'll see is the requirement that summary documentation be publicly accessible, as well as detailed documentation that would be is proposed as a requirement upon ONC request. Next slide, please. Before diving into some of the specifics, I know that the NISC AI risk management was mentioned earlier, but also just to want to flag here about a lot of the proposed terms and definitions heavily rely on the NISC management framework. In some cases, that's connected to the ISO, but we tried our best to make sure that we had consistent see across terms. Next slide, please. As far as some additional, background, you'll see here, I won't necessarily read all of it, but it's really trying to focus on the fact that the proposals are not we try to find a balance between prescriptiveness, but also providing opportunity for industry to kind of further opine on some of this regarding how best to approach methodology around risk management. You'll also see, similar to the source attributes requirement, there is some intersection between the topics and the efforts. So there's definitely some synergy there. So I'd encourage folks to read more about that. And then lastly, the intent is that this is something that would happen throughout the technology's life cycle. Next slide, please. So at a very high level, you'll see here, I've mentioned the risk analysis, the risk mitigation, and governance. And so, we propose that developers of certified health IT analyze potential risks and adverse impacts with predictive decision support intervention for the following characteristics. I know they were listed on the prior slide, and we'll kind of touch a little bit on them on the following. But this deals with validity, the reliability, the robustness, fairness, intelligibility, safety, security, and privacy. The thought being, to the extent there was risk to that that was identified, the developer would need to implement practices to mitigate those risks associated with the predictive DSI. And then lastly, governance. We propose that the developer of certified health IT establish policies and implement controls for predictive DSI, including how data are acquired, managed, or used in a predictive decision support intervention. And I'll touch a little bit more on the following slide. Next slide, please. Here again, we'll not necessarily read the slide, but I know this was as background because I know y'all want to get to the discussions. But the categories that are proposed as far as where the predictive decision support intervention, if there's risk related to the lack of or failure of validity. Next slide, please. as well as the reliability and robustness. Again, won't necessarily read this here. Just know that we, you know, did our best to connect with the underlying NIST of definitions, as well as risk to fairness. Next slide, please. And intelligibility. I know there's a strong interest here. And I know that Jordan spoke to some of this as well as part of the source attributes. So just wanted to make that connection here. Next slide, please. Also risk related to safety as well as security. We understand that there is, you know, often some intersection between safety, security, and maybe even sometimes privacy. People may, you know, use different terms or see it from a different perspective. So we did try to capture all of those here. Next slide, please. And then lastly, you know, the risk to privacy. Again, you'll see in the proposals these terms defined. Interested in the feedback on that the group has through y'all's discussions. Next slide, please. So the thought being, you know, after the risk analysis, there would be a risk mitigation. And I'm sure folks are very familiar with mitigation of risk. Again, we are not prescriptive to where the methodology or the approach that an organization or a developer uses. We do provide resources or, you know, potential places or, you know, activities that could be leveraged. But the key thing being is that the underlying activity of risk mitigation is performed. Next slide, please. Lastly, but not least, we propose to require, you know, as mentioned, governance. And this really gets into the health IT developer establish policies and implement controls for predictive decision support intervention governance. And as mentioned earlier, this includes how data are acquired, managed, and used. And so I'll spend a little time here in that, you know, the governance should, you know, encompass the models, the software, and the data developed or provided by other parties, as well as internally developed interventions. You'll see here also, we talk about what we mean by policies and what we mean by controls. And so, you know, as mentioned, you know, we've tried our best to strike we're seeking to strike a balance between the prescriptiveness and the sufficient description to enable robust reporting of information on the intervention risk management practices. And so, there is also, you know, as mentioned earlier, the proposal to provide a summary of the risk management practices publicly accessible. So just wanted to share that as well. Next slide, please. Lastly, and no, this is probably isn't as visibly appealing as it should be, but this is really just a very high level crosswalk of where in our proposals, you know, we see the connection between the source attributes requirements and the intervention risk management requirements and how that connects back to the concept of FAVES. So just wanted to share that. Next slide, please. Alrighty. So I'll just briefly touch on some of the last, area to focus on oversight and implementation as it relates to the proposals. Next slide, please. Again, you'll see here, this is, again, a snapshot, but we're going to, you know, be focusing on the discussion around oversight. And this really is to, you know, how the proposals would be implemented in terms of ONC's role as part of the broader existing health IT certification program. Next slide, please. Many of you are probably very familiar with the existing health IT certification program. You'll see here this, you know, the proposed new requirements conformance would be found through the real-world testing program. You'll see some information there about dates. There also, you know, as a result, there's a proposal, you know, there would be a requirement, as mentioned, about the publicly available part of the intervention risk management, but also as part of the real-world testing program, the plans and the results are also publicly available on an annual basis. Next slide, please. again, this is just a little bit more detail provided, really focusing on the summary information for the intervention risk management and their availability, as well as the requirement on certified health IT developers with health IT modules that are certified to the proposed regulation, and the requirements that would be associated with that under the existing ONC health IT certification program. Next slide, please. With that, hopefully y'all have enough time to discuss these topics. We tried our best to provide you an overview. With that, I'll turn it back over to the co-chairs.
Thank you so much for that wonderful presentation. I know that there are a bunch of questions in chat. I do invite task force members to also raise their hands so they can ask questions orally as well. Stephen, do you want to help us go through the questions in chat?
So Ike, we didn't discuss this specifically, but one thought was to allow Grace to go ahead and add her commentary before we open up to full questions, because I think some of the items will be addressed there.
Absolutely, that would be fantastic. Grace?
Thank you, everyone. I just wanted to say thank you to ONC and to the task force for giving me the opportunity and some time today to speak from the patient and care partner perspective on some of the DSI proposals. And while I was going to go into some applause moments in my presentation, I think Catherine and the team at ONC really deserve a round of applause for all of the work that they've been doing to bring so many important aspects of what's future facing to the surface for our discussion. Next slide, please. So from the patient and care partner perspective, really the success of the DSI arena in healthcare has to be rooted in inclusive co-creation and symmetry to access of information for all stakeholders, including the patient and care partner voice. So there's mention of utilizing health equity and social determinants of health data, but that's not enough. We really need diverse patient representation as part of the decision and making process and guidance process here. Patients really do need to be included, as well as care partners, as subject matter experts, co-creators, and users of predictive DSI. And I encourage everyone to dream bigger than the status quo, which is currently that the physician or the clinician is the one that's going to be using DSI and benefiting from it. What I'd like you to imagine a world where patients will be asking for these technologies and selecting their care and coordination of care according to who has these DSIs. So the way that the rule is currently written, it seems that we are still looking at the conventional status quo, which is that the clinician or the provider is the end user of DSI. Patients really face an asymmetry of what's available with FAVES information. We have access to none of this or very little. And I encourage, again, clinicians are not the only ones, as we think to the future and the DSI arena, they're not the only ones who are going to need access to this information. So more information and transparency is key. Really, each component of FAVES information also should be inclusively defined from the patient perspective through a co-creative process. Anna posed a question in the chat, how do we protect against the use of poorly defined measures that may not reflect what patients think are important? I think that's a grave, genuine concern. And I think what we need to do is make sure we have diverse representation and all voices included when we define each of these components. What is fair and fair to whom? We need to be readily available to patients as end receivers and end users of DSIs. And really going back, and again, a round of applause for the amazing blog series that was put together across the last year, the 5-part blog series on AI and ML, patients can help reduce the risk of quote unquote market for lemons. Next slide, please. So from the patient and care partner perspective, ONC's role in really advancing transparency, trustworthiness, and predictive technology in healthcare, as well as transparent risk management for and governance of, really is truly appreciated and amazing, and is going to be fruitful in building shared accountability and partnership and advancement of the field collectively from a multi-stakeholder patient partnership approach. I really want to point out that some key things that really jump out as important from the patient and care partner perspective includes requiring developers of certified health IT modules to make all source attributes information publicly available. Also to provide technical capability for patients to be able to electronically access source attribute information, as well as how important it is to provide these feedback loops and the ability to generate a human readable display. If we're going for transparency, all stakeholders need to have all access to information. Next slide, please. I want to take this opportunity to highlight some concerns from the patient and care partner perspective. The biggest one being that patients currently have no access or way to access, request access to predictive DSI outputs. Now, again, in the rule, it is mentioned that these outputs are being used to guide decision-making on care or coordination of care. So I would like to understand, does that mean we're going to formally call these outputs EHI, and are they part of the designated record set? As the rule reads right, the proposed rule reads right now, it's unclear if patients and their care partners are really considered to be HIT users by virtue of perhaps their engagement with patient portals, APIs, or patient-facing tools. So I just want to make sure that we're clear in the language that we're using and not inadvertently excluding patients as active, proactive users of health IT of the future. I'd like to better understand who and what body are really defining the specifics of the FAVES components. Who is identifying what is quote unquote minimum necessary attributes? The voices at that table will matter and dictate what the priorities are. So we have to make sure we have equal, equitable, diverse, inclusive representation in these foundational decision-making processes. And if we don't have that, we do have a risk for introducing or exacerbating existing bias, inequities, and harm. Again, already mentioned this, are these DSI outputs considered EHI, and are they part of the designated record set? This also relates not just to a right of access piece, but also how we think about exporting and sharing information. Does this make the priority different if we recognize that these outputs are indeed EHI and part of the designated record set? One of the biggest concerns that patients and their care partners and patient communities have is, well, what are we doing about errors that may already exist in the medical record? We know that the data that's in our EHRs are powering the future of predictive DSIs and AI and ML powered innovations. Will there be an emphasis on, or greater emphasis on, ensuring curation of medical records by patients and enabling more avenues and opportunities for correcting records or errors that may be in records or addendums in records? And then, we have a number of opportunities to share from the patient and care partner perspective feedback. What does that look like? Will there be a portal here for reporting complaints, similar to maybe the information blocking rule complaints, or others' concerns or bias or discrimination? How would we collect that data upfront instead of waiting long term and saying, oops, we missed a few things? Next slide, please. I'm going to wrap with some high-level recommendations from the patient and care partner perspective. Recommend that ONC more specifically clarifies the role and expectation of patients and care partners as true stakeholders and co-creators in the future of responsible DSI. Recommend ONC ensures diverse representation of the patient voice in work groups and task forces centered around the future of DSI work, such as consensus around FAVES definitions and defining priority of minimum attributes. And lastly, that ONC defines if outputs of predictive DSI that are used to make decisions about an individual's care or coordination of care meet the definition of EHI and if they are part of the designated record set. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Grace. I don't know if I fell off the audio here.
I'm still here. Thank you. And thank you, Grace, for that so much. I personally agree with you wholeheartedly on a number of those factors. I do think that patient perspective, patient involvement is consistent. I'm not quite sure where things fit in terms of ONC and technical standards and FDA's component on safety standards from that side. I think both are relevant, and I do think it needs to be addressed in both forums. You know, patient access to the information is critical, and timely access, excuse me, as well. So that if I know that a DSI tool is going to be used to evaluate my care, I personally would like to know about that several days before my appointment so that I got enough opportunity to understand what tool may be used so that I can have a constructive conversation with my care team, because there may be things that I've got particular concerns about. But if I don't know what tools are being used to evaluate it, I don't know, don't have a context as the questions to ask. So I think that becomes a relevant component as well. That being said, I think we are ready to shift into question and discussion mode, and I do welcome task force members to raise their hands, and we will also go through the questions in chat. Erin.
Steven, I was going to just add to the patient. This is Catherine, if it would be helpful, just to draw some attention in the NPRM, if that's of use.
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, so completely agree. I know there's some language in the, to draw your attention to, that, you know, patients want to know if AI is being used in their care. We do actually solicit comment on whether existing program requirements in the communications conditions and maintenance certification requirement, if that's sufficient to ensure open and transparent discussion regarding the use of predictive DSIs, including discussion between users of certified health IT and patients. And I just wanted to caveat, we actually don't explicitly define users. So if they're, you know, Grace, to your point, if there's public comment on that, definitely let us know. But I just wanted to share that. We also speak to multidisciplinary approaches and ways to engage the patient perspective, you know, trying to learn more about that. And then the other kind of thing, just to full circle on the designated record set discussion, you will find language in the preamble that speaks to, you know, if a patient requests access to their information held by a healthcare provider, the designated record set could include, for example, the underlying data used to generate recommendations about their healthcare, or the underlying information about any use of predictive DSI generated as part of the healthcare decision, as well as other information. And you'll see some footnotes there that touch on the Office for Civil Rights, the HIPAA frequently asked questions that does a parallel with test results and underlying genetic information. So based on this conversation and Grace's remarks, I just wanted to make sure people were familiar or aware of that and where to maybe look as you're contemplating your recommendations and deliberating on your discussions.
Thank you so much for that addition. So I think we'll go back to questions now. Erin.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the questions. I appreciate the overview here and setting the stage. So to me, there's a couple of things that I think we should consider and work through. One is, of course, origin. We've talked about that extensively in the chats here, of the algorithm of the DSI. Where is it coming from? What's the purpose? I understand we can't peel the box back per se in terms of intellectual property, but increasing the trustworthiness is going to be important. And really understanding that synthesis and origin of DSI, where that algorithm came from, is critical. I do think that there is also the notion of private and public algorithms. I'll give you an example. An agent that could be used to derive a DSI algorithm, such as a ChatGPT, right, publicly known, does have vulnerabilities. I just posted a link showing how ChatGPT was hacked, the public version. I will tell you that our health system here, Baptist Health, we are experimenting with a private version of that algorithm builder and building our own DSI algorithms based upon Baptist Health data. And I can tell you there's a lot of opportunity here to shine the light so that the public transparency, if we chose to take that into a course of care, right now it's an alpha version, but take it into a course of care, to, for instance, outputting a treatment option, right? How do we notify that patient, and how do we differentiate between a public DSI algorithm built on publicly available open source code versus private code? How does that work? And also, how does that fall into the rules then of my third part, which is HIPAA and or information blocking, if a patient requests for us, who maybe uses a private algorithm generator such as ChatGPT to build an algorithm, and they want to know the data that went into that, who's responsible? I would take it the health system is, but is that called out specifically in 21st Century Cures where those pieces are? The answer is I don't know. So I think there's a few dimensions here that we need to look through and think through to make sure that we're being 100% transparent with technology and these algorithms. And as I'm always saying, not be creepy with technology. Thank you.
Creepy. You want to respond?
Yeah, I thought really quickly to respond with one clarifying point is that the source attributes we walked through today for predictive decision support are in addition to the, you know, extant source attributes that include bibliographical citations, the developer of the intervention, funding of the intervention, and release and, if applicable, revision dates for the intervention. And so I think some of, you know, what's already in regulation would address at least some of the concerns you mentioned, Aaron.
Jordan, I will respectfully push back a little bit. I do believe we're missing geolocation data and other location that's specific to the DSI algorithm, and ensuring that we do not have some nefarious actor in a third world country trying to insert themselves into a course of care. And I believe Grace said this in her chat there, and then suddenly codify an archaic process into workflow because we can't peel back the veil of transparency. I think there's other componentry here we need to think about beyond some of the existing source data. So I appreciate your perspective. You're right. It will give us some breadcrumbs, but I think more needs to be done to ensure public trust, because the minute that trust is violated, I can't see us coming back from that.
Anna's hand is up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things that I'm concerned about. I mean, Aaron just referenced the comment that I made about the incorporation of measures that patients that are currently out there that are developed in a very analog, quote unquote, open process for clinical guideline development that do not reflect the interests of what patients think are important. How do we keep that from being incorporated behind a black box into an algorithm that spits out an appropriate treatment for a patient that may not be appropriate? I mean, in a very analog case, a couple of times that I've been hospitalized in recent years, especially in ER with diabetic ketoacidosis, the ER doctor, who is not an expert in endocrinology and is not accustomed to somebody like me, who understands a lot about diabetes treatment and measures, always wants to give me more insulin than I need because I'm very insulin sensitive. So if I, and so far I have not been completely incapacitated and passed out in the hospital, so I have been able to actively advocate and refuse the insulin that the ER doctor used based off of clinical guidelines. So in that case, insulin can be very easily deadly. So this is the kind of thing that in an analog environment can already be very deadly. So how do we keep measures such as hemoglobin A1C, which is highly unreflective of reality with disease, as being the ultimate measure for inpatient emergency care, for instance, or static glucose levels, which are like a snapshot of where you are at the time rather than a trend line about where you've been and where you're going. Again, this is just diabetes. This is just, you know, the thing that I live with, but it is and has been a very deadly scenario in an analog environment. I don't think it's appropriate for us to permit those kinds of things to be hidden behind a black box under the guise of intellectual property. I don't know exactly what the answer is, but that stuff has got to be exposed somehow, some way, to people who could challenge the inputs and what is being defined as good health and appropriate health. It can't just be done by engineers and consulting doctors at a hospital system or at a health IT company. And then secondly, I think transparency is a baseline. I need to dig into what Catherine just posted in terms of the real world testing thing. I have not yet done that, but for a patient who has a lot of other stuff to deal with and a very complex, in addition to trying to work jobs, care for themselves, care for their families, whatever the scenario, asking them to dig into the details of what, you know, a particular decision support tool or, some of these details, it's just not appropriate and it's not fair. And I think that we have to think beyond transparency and more into how do we actively challenge these models and how do we actively challenge them on an ongoing basis to see if they actually are producing results that make sense. And I'll stop there. And I thought Grace's comments were excellent and raised some really, really important points that I hope we consider.
Thank you, Anna. Anyone want to respond to Anna before we go on? Great. Hans, your hand has been up and down and up, and now it's up.
I think it's up, yeah. Thank you. I really appreciate the background provided. There's a question that I have that was also voiced in the chat and ties a couple of the comments from Grace and Aaron as well. And it goes to the transparency and who actually has that transparency. The focus of the proposed rule is around certified HIT, and the HIT that is most likely and typically going to be certified are in many cases actually consumers of such DSI. And particularly as we are looking at AI, ML, and we go up that path from the simple algorithms into these more predictive models, there is more external use. But we already see that currently decision support capabilities, clinical decision support capabilities are being added outside the EHR or being referenced. What is the approach that both from the perspective of DSI provided by services capabilities that are really not developed by the certified HIT, but that are included, accessible, et cetera, through that certified HIT. How do we engage that that community, that set of developers, where we ultimately are going to depend on to provide all the information that's being asked for and that the HIT that's being certified needs to make available? How do we get them engaged? They are HIT. They do provide capabilities there. And they are not necessarily currently incented or indicated that they need to certify, by which we could get access to this documentation as well. Yet that's going to be extremely relevant in the context of a number of comments of having a library available, where is it, et cetera, to do that, which means we need to go to the source, not to the intermediary only. What are the thoughts on how to engage them and have that information more easily available as we're trying to get the transparency that we're trying to get?
And I think that's a question for the ONC.
Correct.
So Hans, sorry, do you want Hans to restate that in no more than two sentences?
That would be great.
That's always a challenge. How do you intend to engage the CDS DSI developers in enabling this data to be transparently available along the lines of whether it's library or otherwise, but to the actual intermediary and consumers of that, and going back to the source, not only the intermediaries?
Sure. So one thing we include in the proposed rule is a request for comment about whether, and this isn't exactly answering your question, but whether CDS hooks or other tools could be ways in which information around these source attributes were transported from developers that are not developers of certified health IT into the health IT module. So that is one related question, would be getting this information transported. I think the broader one is how to engage or motivate folks to provide this information at all who are not developers of certified health IT. Towards that end, we've included language around the need to clearly indicate that information is missing when it is not provided by these developers. And we have the intention that that this will drive folks to say, well, if this information is missing, I can't verify that the tool is trustworthy and perhaps not use it. And you know, there is, in essence, a market-based incentive there. I think this does also intersect with other policies from other parts of HHS, including FDA, that I think all play distinct roles in the ecosystem.
Yeah, and just to add to Jordan's comment, I guess in addition, there is a section in the preamble that talks about other parties. And I'd say consistent with prior discussion, or ONC's prior discussion regarding third-party developed evidence-based DSIs under the current requirements, we anticipate that developers of certified health IT would obtain the information on the predictive DSIs from, you know, as mentioned, the model developers, the owners, or the creators in most instances. And I'd say this is consistent with what ONC has historically expected, noting that in the 2014 edition proposed rule, that it would be the third party from which the developer of certified health IT would get this information. Just wanted to add that as well.
Yeah, and maybe to react to that, I think that still focuses very much on the intermediaries, the certified HIT, less so on the actual original source. And I think it behooves everybody to identify opportunities how they can be better engaged so that information is available, that's available in a standard fashion, whether CDS Hooks is the right one or not. There are a couple of different ways that we can look at that. But to really identify ways, whether it's ONC or like the combination of ONC and CMS in other areas, ONC and FDA, how can we ensure that the sources are providing the relevant information as they are making their capabilities available, so that this is not a challenging, highly challenging event to pull that all together. There has to be an easier way to do that for everybody involved, whether it's providers, the patients, anybody that's using it, to understand what's being used.
Thank you, Hans. Madel, you've been very patient and your hand is up.
Thank you so much, Stephen. And I want to thank all of our presenters today for the amazing context, and then also Grace for your excellent recommendations. I have two questions for the ONC, and this is expanding upon what Hans just mentioned. And I just want to make sure that I'm hearing this or very clearly. I want to bring up the scenario of when providers themselves, so let's say health systems, are developing their own predictive DSI. At my organization here at UCLA Health, but I also sit on some additional University of California wide efforts that are looking at data insights and innovation, there's already been a movement of developing, of course, our own predictive DSIs. And there's always caution in how those DSIs are being developed. How will this proposed rule be applied to provider organizations themselves in terms of making sure that we are identifying all of the source attributes, and of course all of that information is as transparent as possible to the internal organization of users that will be using it, as well as to the patient? Does this apply to that group as well? So that's my first question for ONC. And then the second question that I have is, when we're thinking about FAIDs in general, and we're thinking about the transparency and really making sure that all of the end users, and I'll say all the end users, whether they're the health IT module owners, the providers and clinicians and patients, if we're trying to make sure that everyone's very aware of this content, when there are elements that are not available, or when there are elements that are available, but yet they have various different report outs, has ONC considered having a model or having recommendations of what would be a strong DSI in terms of all of the various different elements, or what may not be as strong? Because what I'm concerned about is, especially our providers, clinicians, and patients may see the attributes, but they're unable to interpret if that DSI is appropriate or not. And if it truly is, for instance, representative of themselves, if they're a patient or the patient population they're serving, and how to actually apply that in an appropriate way that will not cause increased bias as well as increased adverse outcomes or harm. So just those two questions for ONC.
Great. This is Catherine. I'll take the first question, and my colleague Jordan may be best suited for the latter. But in short, the proposals, much like the existing regulatory authority of ONC, the proposed requirements would be on developers of certified health information technology. The question about kind of what role or how the healthcare provider organization plays as it relates to these proposals, I mentioned earlier, I would say there's some language about other parties. And so to the extent a predictive decision support intervention was enabled or interfaced by a certified health IT module, and if that was developed, for example, by a healthcare provider organization, the proposal, much like the current, requirements around third parties and other parties, the expectation would be that the certified health IT developer would get any necessary information from the other party. In this case, it could be the healthcare provider organization. The other thing just to draw your attention to is in the preamble, I failed to mention there are a few other very important requests for comments or requests for information towards the end of the risk management section. And one of those includes users of certified health IT, particularly around healthcare provider organizations. So that might be something of interest. A lot of the conversation is around what else can ONC do to help the users. There's also two other requests for comments that are there. One is focusing on the ethical, legal, social implications of data. So realizing, ONC's authority, we thought it was helpful to at least have the conversation. And the department is interested in receiving any comments on that. And then also we understand that there is a concern around the underlying data quality, appropriate use, particularly around some of the, as well as the technical standards and the quality of data and things of that nature. Again, not part of some of the proposals, but you will see language in there and requesting for comment. So just wanted to add that in. I guess I'll turn it over to Jordan to answer your second question.
As Catherine indicated, we do have a request for comment around what really, I guess, HHS-wide could consider doing to help providers gain the competencies to make use of this information that we're proposing to make transparent. And so, your question is very much one on our minds as we develop that request for comment is how can we ensure folks have the information they need to determine if a DSI is a strong DSI. Within the contracts that of the proposed rule, we are not proposing that ONC would play a role in saying what a strong DSI is or would look like. We're really proposing transparency around that. And of course, I would point towards FDA's role in reviewing decision support that is a medical device and the safety and effectiveness of that decision support as kind of a separate authority.
You're running short on time because we need to go to public comment in just a moment, but I do want to recognize Steve Lane, and we will deal with, or we will address, I guess, a couple of the comments in the chat as well. Stephen?
Yeah, I just wanted to raise a couple of things that have come up in the chat. One is, when we talk about the users of the certified health IT, do we include in that the patients, caregivers who are using the health IT by way of the portal or an API? That's a directed question to ONC. Are patients considered users of certified health IT?
So I think we've intentionally haven't defined users of certified health IT. And certainly we know that today in some cases they are, and in some cases, focus on health systems and healthcare providers.
So we're just going to leave that as a hanging question. The other question has come up here repeatedly as to what portion or components of the DSI might be considered EHI for the purposes of information sharing.
This seems to somewhat relate to the question earlier or the comments that Grace shared about the designated record set. So I would maybe encourage looking into that particular area as it relates to existing HIPAA interpretation, given the connection between the designated record set and EHI.
Well, I guess I was looking into it by asking you the question.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's I would say links to that, and I'm happy to put those in the chat for easy reference.
Okay, that would be great, because I think that is a key question. You know, that has been we've been going back and forth. Okay, we've got public comment coming up in 2 minutes. The one task force member who has contributed to the chat but has not taken the mic yet is Cheryl. And Cheryl, I wanted to give you a chance, especially since you weighed in on a detailed comment by Julie Moss, and wanted to see if you wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Stephen. Yeah, I know I've been fairly quiet on the raising of my hand so far. I will be adding some of these comments also to the Google Doc over the weekend, so you'll be able to see them there. But, you know, really my focus is on what we need to do to ensure that the certification process, as it applies to decision support, not only fulfills the requirements that are needed to ensure that there's sufficient data utilized, but that there's knowledge about that data. And you know, the whole concern is it's quite cumbersome to identify what was tested, what was not tested. If there was at least a publicly available data sandbox that had a minimum required amount of data that we would be able to utilize to say, yes, these decision support systems have exercised that, I think it would provide more validity around the depth of the testing and also the scope of the testing. Because at the end of the day, you know, this is a rapidly developing field. And without having specific requirements, it can do much more harm than good, especially related to you know, as I mentioned, rare and orphan conditions. And there are already examples where we use decision support based on cost information. And I'll bring it up again on vitamin D testing. It's a very common thing. They say a normal person doesn't need it. But if you're a vitamin D resistant rickets patient and that test is used to modify your medication, it's needed, but they have to fight to get that test paid for, and it can be quite expensive. So there's an example in today's world that, you know, already exists where patients are being harmed and burdened. And so how do we prevent that same exact scenario going forward? You know, these are the things that we need to ensure. We can't plan for everything, but we need to plan enough so that we're not adding burden and we're not adding harm to those patients that are underrepresented. And I don't believe that in the Bill of Rights for AI that they just released, that it properly addresses it with the reference to disabilities, because without knowing what data was used for testing those models, the model can't take into account how it's going to address data that it doesn't know about. So it's extremely important that we are very cautious and careful. And quite honestly, I think we need to take some time to ensure that the governance around the certification of these models is important and taken into consideration. So my comments will be along all of those lines, but thank you for the opportunity to speak up.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. And we're going to go to public comment now.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. So we are going to open up the meeting for public comment. If you're on the Zoom and you would like to make a comment, please use the raise hand feature, which is located on the Zoom toolbar on the bottom of your screen. If you're participating just by phone today, you can press *9 to raise your hand. And once called upon, press *6 to mute and unmute your line. So we'll give folks a few seconds to queue up if they have any of the public has any comments at this point.
And I'd particularly invite Julie, if you're interested in adding to any of the discussion, feel free to raise your hand and jump in. She looks like we may have lost Julie. Oh, well. Luckily, she got in on the chat. I will bring everyone's attention to one of the very first items I put into the chat, which was some new resources that the ONC has put together and posted. Specifically, these are Word versions of the NPRM, as well as a very impressive public comment template. So those are, we thank the ONC for putting those together.
Okay, I am not seeing any hands raised at this point. So let's conclude the public comment period. And I'll turn it back to you, Stephen, and to continue the discussion. We still have about 6 minutes left on the call.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine, for providing the links that you put into the chat there. Very helpful. I do want to point out that actually maybe we can pop back to the spreadsheet again. Thank you, Edith. Sarah's got that. So we were displaying earlier the spreadsheet, and we'll display it here briefly. Again, we are still on the, I think, the very second row, first meaningful row in the spreadsheet, the first item that we're addressing here in group number two. We've captured a number of member recommendations, and Adele gave a justification to hers. And then we've captured a few things in the task force discussion. I did copy and paste in there the recommendations that Grace provided in her last slide, and a little bit about our discussion today. But obviously, there's been rich discussion. Cheryl, you mentioned that you were planning on getting back to the spreadsheet, and I would really encourage everyone to do that. And also, don't be shy about editing what you've already put in there. You know, if you want to tighten it up or refocus it based on the discussions that we've been having. Again, we want to drive towards specific recommendations. So I think especially in column G, if you want to go back to your member recommendations and refine those in any way, a number of us have put some recommendations in there. Maybe if you modify it, just maybe put a little notation there, you know, modified and the date or something. So, and then what we're going to do is hopefully have time to come back and work through these in detail. Sometimes some of that working through falls to the co-chairs because we don't have the time. So what we may do is take your recommendations and perhaps modify them slightly, rephrase them into draft recommendations to reconsider with the task force as a whole.
And this is from a process standpoint. Please feel free to insert comments tagged with your initials or first name, not necessarily at the bottom of the particular cell. If somebody else has made a comment on a related issue and you want to add additional information or share a different perspective or reemphasize the point, please feel free to do so. For convenience, please do put it kind of close to the original comment just to help us link the information together.
Okay, any comments from the task force members or from the ONC, frankly, any of you? We've got just a few minutes left. I want to specifically give a chance to task force members who haven't had a chance to speak up. Phil, Deo, Naresh, Jim, anything you guys want to add? If not, that's fine. Again, we do not have to burn every moment of our hours here. Really want to thank everybody for your engagement. Want to especially thank the members of the public who came and participated. Obviously, public comment is open, and those of you who are investing the time to be here are going to be well prepared to contribute to and provide public comment through the ONC process. And as I said, they have made that easier for us all by posting a template to facilitate that.
Stephen, this is Catherine. I just wanted to say thanks for allowing us to share a little bit about what's in the proposed rule. I did also want to circle back. My audio cut out, I think, when you were asking a follow-up question about the users, and I did put in the chat a link to some language in the preamble that talks about the user and who ONC sees as users, generally speaking. I know elsewhere and some of the rule, you know, end users are referred to, but you'll see in this proposed section kind of some of that discussion regarding users.
Seth, Steve, can you make sure to cut that out of the chat, make sure that it's shared via email with the task force members?
Great suggestion. Yeah, I will ask the ONC team to capture those links and include them with the next email out. All right, so preparing for our next meeting, do we have that last slide that shows the upcoming meetings? There we go. God, you guys are good. Okay, so this group is meeting again in a week on May 10. We have three items to touch on: ONC certification criteria, discontinuing the year-themed editions, that should be fairly uncontroversial, requirement for health IT developers to update their previously certified health IT, and assurances, condition and maintenance of certification requirements. So we look forward to diving into those next week. That will be followed by a week off for this work group, as we will provide a brief update to the HITAC, and then we will be back again on May 19th to dig in further. We do have SMEs coming for the ECR discussion, as well as the patient requested restrictions, I think. So we'll be having a lot of lively discussions. With that, thank you all. We will end on time. Really appreciate your participation, and we will see you next week.